Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to this week's podcast. Before we get to my guest, I want to thank everybody who's been listening. Got a lot of great response on the Colin Quinn interview. If you haven't heard it, listen to it. He's really, really cool. Please leave comments on iTunes. We appreciate those who have, but we would love more. Say nice things, and nice things happen to us. We keep building the numbers. Please send the podcast around. I'm going to be in New York City again this week. Not on the road much right now, so look me up. And I'm at the Comic Strip, the Comedy Cellar, Stand Up New York, Gotham Comedy Club, and the Stand. So all the big clubs here in the city. And this guest this week is Mistress Carrie. She is a legendary radio jock in Boston at WAAF, a huge station up there, and just a super, super cool person and a really dynamic personality. And you're going to love this. She just jumps out of the speakers right into your head. She's awesome. You're going to love it. Anyway, thank you for listening. Enjoy this week's podcast, and we will see you next week. Very excited to have with me today someone that I think is absolutely hilarious, who we've become very close very quickly. She's like a sister that I didn't know I had. She's a fellow New Englander, and more importantly, a fellow Italian. And it's Mistress Carrie, the host, afternoon host on WAAF in Boston Radio, one of the big radio stations in Boston and in the country. And I, my whole life growing up in New England, I would listen to that. And then also the music director for WAAF. Hey, how are you, Mistress
What's
Carrie?
What's up, my mister from another whatever, or brother from another mother?
I came on with you a couple of times when I was doing shows up in Connecticut and Rhode Island, up in New England, and we just hit it off. And I wanted people to, I think you're so hilarious. And
thank you.
Yeah. Oh God. It's like,
I love it when you're on my show.
Oh, it's just like we've known each other forever, and you're amazing because you've literally spent your entire career at one radio station, and I don't know anybody that's done that. Radio people tend to move around. You were an intern from 91 to 94, then you were on the street team from 94 to 99, and then nighttime jock, middays jock through 2000, from 2001 to 2005. How did you get them to put you on the air? Like, it doesn't, no, I don't mean it like, how did
Gun
you get a
point.
Show? No. How, like, what did you, because I could see you, like, clearly making a case for yourself, but what did you say? You were an intern, and then how did that sort of blossom into being on the air?
Well, I wanted to go to school because I thought I was going to work in a recording studio. I wanted to work with music, but I always thought I was going to be, like, in a recording studio, kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah, you went to Newberry College in Framingham State for radio programs, right?
Yeah, because I couldn't really find a place that would allow me to go to school to kind of learn how to be like a recording engineer, which is kind of what I always thought. I loved music. I grew up in the 80s, so it was all about spandex and hair. And
Blondie and
just
all
that. Yeah, and even later on in the 80s, I was in high school from 86 to 90. So It was like Bon Jovi and Skid Row and Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses, like all of that kind of stuff, and I loved it.
Man, you look good, by the way. You're hot.
You like that big hair picture?
You don't age. I'll tell you that right now. It's
the Sicilian. It's,
and yeah, you know, and the fact is that we Italians emote like at the drop of a hat, so there's never any tension in our bodies.
Yeah, no, not at all.
So, what? But how do you know in like high school that you want to do something that specific?
I loved music. It's all I cared about. Like right. I used to dream that John Bon Jovi's tour bus was going to break down on my street and knock on my door for directions. P.S. I lived on a cul-de-sac, so it was just never going to happen.
And you would have fucked him, right?
When I was, hell yeah, I still would now. Are you kidding me?
Because he's here right now. No, I'm just
God,
kidding.
Oh, can you be like Oprah and be like, you got a Bon Jovi. You got a Bon Jovi.
He aged well. That's the one guy that didn't try to do facelifts.
He's Italian.
Hey, Bonzon, come on.
So I knew I wanted to work in music. It was like a huge time in metal and rock and roll. And I couldn't find a place to go to school. And I grew up working at my grandfather and my parents' like Sicilian bakery. Mm. Like that's what I did growing up. Mm. So it was like you either go to college and be the first kid in your family to go to college, or you're going to work in the bakery. Those are your choices. Right. So pick one.
Right. What were you good at making? Were you good at making anything in particular at the bakery?
Oh, I can. Well, I don't know what the hell you guys call them in Rhode Island, but we call them grinders.
Oh yeah, we call them grinders.
Yeah. So
for people like listening, a grinder is like a hero sandwich.
Except a grinder, the reason why it gets the name, as far as I know, is because it's made on really hard crusted bread, so it's the kind of sandwich that like scrapes the roof of your mouth.
Oh, is that
like,
why it's called that?
That's what I was told. I could be full of crap, but I thought that that's what the difference was.
Rhode Island, we call a milkshake a cabinet. I don't know why.
We don't call them
and
that.
And so there was a New Yorker cartoon one time with a waiter standing in the kitchen going, some guy from Rhode Island ordered a cabinet and a grinder, and he had a meat grinder in one hand and a kitchen cabinet in the other. So hilarious.
So I can make the hell out of a grinder. I mean, we did everything. Pastries, cannolis. We made our own Sicilian pizza.
Oh, wow.
I mean, my grandfather even made his own head cheese. So I have memories as a kid of him behind the giant oven with a welding helmet on, blowtorching the hair off the pig's head.
Oh, my God. You serious?
And people wonder what the hell's the matter with me. It's like a horror film. Like I had like Rob Zombie's childhood. And people wonder. So I loved working at the bakery, and I still miss it to this day.
Oh, you did like it. See, I grew
I
up,
loved
we
it.
We grew up so similarly. I grew up in a family business in a furniture store, different store, but same idea, like around the family all day. Were you guys yelling at each other a lot? I remember.
Yeah, we still do that now. Yeah, and like I'd be in school in like the first grade, right?
Yeah.
And all the kids sitting around me had like peanut butter and jelly on Wonder Bread. And I was the weirdo that had a fresh baked bulky roll with imported provolone cheese and homemade prosciutto with a garden grown tomato and fresh basil.
With a lovely pickle on the side.
Yeah. And I wanted the peanut butter and jelly.
Oh, you did?
And I would give a limb for one of those prosciutto sandwiches now.
Oh,
are you kidding
me?
I didn't know how good I had it.
My father used to make me my lunches, and we used to get the tuna fish in the can with the oil. And he'd make the thing, and then he'd make the sandwich at like 6:30 in the morning. By the time I ate it at 1, all the oil like absorbed into the
sandwich. Oh, yeah.
There was no bread. It was like having notebook paper for bread.
And you better eat it.
And I could take like one bite, and then I'd gag, and I would never eat lunch because he would always make these sandwiches. But we had a family. We were into the Italian food, too, and my uncle was so Italian. He had an Italian meat slicer in his basement, and he kept the whole loaves like in a refrigerator, so he'd cut it fresh. Like, he was out of his mind. Like,
dude, I have a meat slicer in my kitchen right now.
Oh, my God.
The one from the bakery. It's like 60 years old.
Oh, that's awesome. So,
and it's awesome.
Yeah, and you still use it?
Of course I use it. Wouldn't you? You know how they say if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail? If you have a meat slicer, you want to put everything in it. I'll slice whatever. I make beef jerky because I'm one of those crazy zombie apocalypse prepper people.
Oh, you are?
Oh, yeah, because the zombies are coming if you're, you know. So I use that for all kinds of stuff. Plus, the whole family comes to my house for the holidays. So I'm like a catering service at Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Oh, my. How are you doing that and raising a kid and running a station? Like, how are you doing all
that?
Well,
I'm not raising a kid. I have pugs, which is like raising a kid because they're small and they're fat and they shit everywhere. But I run, you know, I'm here at the radio station, and then, you know, then I have the craziness at the house, but.
Yeah. So you.
But yeah, it's like a catering service.
You were going to use like a dating service?
No, catering service.
So were you going to, you thought, okay, I'll do the bakery. That'll be my life.
Well, I was fifth generation. So it's like, it's getting to the point where, you know, I'm in high school and they're like, are you taking over the bakery or are you going to go to school? Like, what the hell are you doing? And the thought of like staggering in to work at 2 o'clock every Sunday morning for the rest of my life, I was like, I love music too much. I was always, you know, just the weird music kid. It was the only thing I was ever passionate about.
Did you play music?
I did in like the, you know, I was the band geek. So I played clarinet and then like I played the bass drum and, you know, but I sucked. I mean, I have no musical talent. That's why I make a living criticizing other people's. I wish I had musical talent, but I just don't. I won't even sing karaoke unless I'm wasted because I know I'm going to suck.
No, to this day? Come on. I'm sure. No? Well,
I can't sing. You've heard my voice. You really want to hear me sing?
Yeah, that's
sounds
true.
Like I've been gargling glass since I was 12. No. So I was like, all right, I got to find something to do with music. It's what I'm passionate about. And they're telling me if I go to college, they'll help me out, you know?
They were going to support you in that. Well, that's cool.
Well, they wanted me to go to school because nobody in the family had ever done that. And, you know, as a kid, because, you know, it's what you do when you grow up in the bakery. Before I even went to kindergarten, I was working at the bakery. I was the only four-year-old that could add up amounts in my head and count change back from a 20 before I started kindergarten. So I used to sell my grandfather's vegetables from his garden in the bakery, and he gave me a dollar a day, which back then was a big deal. And what I didn't know is that he was putting the rest of the money I made selling the vegetables away in the big giant safe, like in every mobster movie.
I thought you were going to say like in like Bonds or something like that.
No, no. Well, we found out later after he died that he was hiding money frozen in like gutted fish in the freezer.
No, are you serious?
And it was, I swear to God, and it was like rolled up in plastic bags inside like quarts of marinara sauce in the freezer because he grew up during the Depression. He didn't trust the banks.
Oh, I thought he was like on the run from
the law. He didn't like to keep money in the bank, so he had it hidden everywhere.
Oh my God.
So he had all this money that I made as a kid hidden away from me.
Oh, for you. Oh, that's great.
For me. So when he died and it was time for me to go to college, I had basically the first year of my college paid for with this money my grandfather had squirreled away.
Wow, that's amazing.
So my parents were like, if you're going to go to school, you can use Papa's money. And if you screw off and you flunk out, you just wasted all that money.
Yeah.
But if you do well and you prove to us that you're going to take it serious, then we'll help you the rest of the way.
Yeah. But why would they think that you wouldn't take it seriously?
Because I was that kid in school that, like, without really trying too hard, got average and above average grades. Had I applied myself, I could have gotten straight A's. But I just wanted to hang out and talk with my friends and talk about music and go to concerts. It's all I cared about.
Yeah. Well, and so you had a motivating, you were motivated to do well in that first year.
Yeah, for many reasons, not only because of the music, but because I was finally studying stuff I was interested in.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I got a friend who's got a kid in school, the kid's not focused, whatever, and it's like, he's just got to find something he's interested in, and then he's going to crush it, you know?
Exactly. So I couldn't find a place thinking I wanted to work in a recording studio. So I was like, all right, well, I'll go to school for radio and communications. At least I'll learn how to edit audio and like all of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so after my freshman year, I got an internship at this recording studio in Worcester. And
I know Worcester, the Aku and the Boynton Bar.
This place was right across the street from what used to be the Centrum, which is now the DCU Center.
Oh, yeah. And I remember the Centrum.
Yeah. So it was right there. So I was like, oh, this is going to be great. There's going to be rock stars everywhere. I'm going to be recording all these famous bands. It's going to be like the glamorous life. It's going to be amazing. And I spent a summer recording like a 27-piece mariachi band, like literally checking the microphones one maraca at a time. And I was like, oh, my God, is this what it's really like to work in a recording studio? And I realized that like that dream of what I thought it was in all the videos on MTV, like, that's not the reality. Recording studios record everything, even the music you don't like. And I was like, this sucks. So a girlfriend of mine that I was in college with, she was interning at AAF, which at the time was around the corner in Worcester. This is 1991.
I was listening to it at the time. AAF was based out of Worcester?
Oh, yeah, for years and years and years.
I always thought it was downtown Boston.
No, well, it is now, but back then it was in Worcester. So her and I used to meet and go for lunch while we were doing our internship during the summer.
And by the way, your experience like in a recording studio and what you thought it would be and what it was exactly parallel to the life of a stand-up. You start going, you see him on TV and you're like, oh, this is going to be cool. I'll be on TV soon. And then you're in dive bars just trying to get drunks to pay attention to. And you're like, this isn't as glamorous as I thought it was going to be.
What, you're not getting like a stand-up special on HBO and starring in a movie with The Rock? That's not how it works?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like, every once in a while I go home. Not now, but you know, I very first started, I was like, when are you going to get your own show? I'm like, you know, I didn't think of that. Let me call NBC and order up one of my own.
They got a vending machine that sells those?
Yeah, exactly. Like the old Italians, they're like, you should have your show. You're funny. I'm funny. Like then they all start putting themselves in the show. They're out of their minds. So you have a friend at AAF.
Yeah, she was interning because we were going to college together for communications and she got an internship at AAF and I got it at this recording studio and we met for lunch and I went to the radio station to like meet her for lunch that day. And the production director, so at that time, the production director made everything. So anything you heard that wasn't music or a DJ is considered production.
Mm-hmm.
So it's commercials, it's all the stuff you hear in between the songs, all of that kind of stuff. And his name was Mitch Todd. He still works in the industry now. He had this big bombastic voice, just awesome. Mm-hmm. And he walks in the lobby and looks at me and he's like, who are you? I'm like, oh, you know, I'm Carrie. I'm intern around the corner at the recording studio. I'm here to meet my friend Kristen for lunch.
You didn't talk that quietly. I can't imagine you would.
No. Well, no. But I mean, you know.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
So he's like, how do you like that internship over there? And I was like, well, to be perfectly honest, it's not exactly what I thought it was going to be, but it's almost done. He goes, well, what are you going to do for the rest of the summer? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. And he goes, why don't you intern for me? And I was like, okay.
Wow.
So at that time, like, audio was all on tape. It wasn't digital yet. So I spent the rest of the summer dubbing, you know, commercials onto cassettes and cleaning the tape heads and, you know, doing all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because they would, like, have to, the guy, somebody would have to physically put a tape in the machine and hit a button.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You were editing it with a razor blade. I mean, it was, this is old school stuff, which is what I was learning in school.
Well, you're
still,
Italian.
You know?
You know how to handle a razor blade.
Hey,
so.
Please, give me a break.
Why don't you use your slicer? Not
So every once in a while, he needed a girl's voice for just some random girl's voice in a commercial. So, you know, he'd be like, do you want to do it? And that was like the biggest deal.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh my God, can I dub a copy of that commercial and take it home and play it for my parents? Like, my voice is in a commercial.
Yeah.
Ooh, you know?
It's crazy, right? Comes out of that box and you're like, oh my God. Yep. Yeah.
So I interned at AAF for like 3.5 years. And I worked for everybody. I worked in the production office for a while. I worked in the promotion office for a while. Then I went into the on-air studio and I started, you know, back then you were playing CDs and all the commercials were on carts, they call them, which look like 8-track tapes almost.
Right.
And they play like on a minute loop or whatever. So you would go in and help the DJ set up for their show and pull all their songs and, you know, pull their carts and stuff. So I did that for like 3.5 years.
Wow.
And I eventually ended up, you know, in those 3.5 years interning for the morning show, Hillman, who's actually still on the air here, he's on right before me every morning.
Hmm.
And so I would intern for him. By now, I'm at Framingham State College. The radio station had moved from Worcester to Westboro. So I was like 10 minutes away going to school. And one of the reasons I picked Framingham State was that it was so close to the radio station.
And were you learning anything at Framingham State that was value added? I mean, you already knew a lot.
Yeah, they actually had an FM broadcast radio station, and their communications program was really hard to get into.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But because Newberry College was only an associate's degree program, I had a lot of the classes I needed for my major already taken in the first 2 years.
Oh.
So I transferred into Framingham State, and I had really good grades, and I was the general manager at the radio station at Newberry College, and I was interning at a real radio station. And so I got accepted, so I would get up at like 3:30 in the morning,
because
I grew up in the suburbs. I would go to Westboro, intern for the morning show from 5 to 10, get out of the morning show at 10 or 10:15, race down Route 9 to Framingham, which is like 10 or 15 minutes away, go to class at 11, be in class all day as a commuting student, and then leave class and race home to close the bakery at home every night.
Jesus. I mean, you know, that's how are you even staying awake during classes?
Cigarettes and Coke. Coca-Cola, not cocaine.
Get out. Get it. It was cocaine. Come
I'm
on.
The only person you've ever met in the music business that's never done cocaine.
Are you serious?
That? I swear to God.
I was curious about that. Like, how do you stay? Plus, you're like a beautiful woman. I'm sure guys are like hitting on you and with the thing. And
no, I was so focused on, because I was finally studying and involved in something that I loved.
Your parents must have seen a different character.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I had to manage money because my internship wasn't paying me anything. So I had to work at the bakery because I needed money to pay for the car and the gas and the insurance to get back and forth to school. And so I graduated with my bachelor's, and right before graduation, I got hired on the street team, which is, you know, the ones that drive the radio station vans that hand out the bumper stickers when you get out of concerts, kind of stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And back then, I think I was making $3.75 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first girl they ever hired to work on the street team because you were setting up like PA systems and stuff. And
they only hired guys up to that point?
Yeah, because the gear was so big and you were driving big vans and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I had been around and, you know, I was like, I don't understand why I can't do this job. I wasn't raised like what you would think an Italian girl was raised. Like, I was raised by a dad that had two daughters and he was the oldest son. So he raised me like the oldest son of the Italians, because even though I was a girl, his kid wasn't going to get treated like she was any less than because she was a girl.
Well, that's funny because Italians, especially that generation, tend to overly protect the girl and they dote over the girl. Like, that's kind of unique, I think, for that generation.
Yeah, no, I wasn't treated like that. I mean, my dad only had daughters. So he was like, well, I better teach you how to kick ass on your own, because you're not going to have an older brother sticking up for you, and you're going to make your way in this world, so you better figure it out. So I didn't take any crap from anybody. And so I was like, I can do this job. I can drive the van. I can lift a PA system. Like, give me a break.
Cool.
You know, I was lifting these giant prosciuttos back at the bakery. I can handle lifting a speaker.
It's true.
You know?
That's so true. You probably, oh my God, that's so hilarious. Unfortunately, still to this day, women are seen to be in certain types of jobs and not in others. So I'm sure a lot of the guys were like, what is this chick doing lifting all this stuff?
And until they saw me working.
And then they were like, but did you know in your head at this point, like, this was going to lead to something bigger? Did you feel like
Really, yeah, I kind of felt like I had invested a lot of time. I mean, I worked for free for 3.5 years. I had 2 degrees, one in broadcast communications and one in radio. So I was like, all right, now I don't want to work in a recording studio, but I thought I was going to end up like a producer, like the conductor of the show and like working behind the scenes. I really thought that's where I was going to end up. I loved working in the studio with the air talent, and I loved watching the behind the scenes, you know, how everything got put together and how the on-air product sounded like there was a 3-ring circus in the studio, even if there wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I loved it. So while I was working on the street team, you know, that's a part-time job, really.
Yeah.
All my student loans kicked in. So I was like, oh, crap. Like, I need another job that's going to supplement my income. So I was working as like the night part-time manager at Spencer Gifts, like selling vibrators for bachelorette parties and stuff because it was close to the radio station.
Yeah.
And then because the radio station back in the day, they used to use like the street team kids and whatever. Whenever the radio station would have a concert, they would use the street team as like the roadies.
Oh,
so
okay.
I started learning how sound systems got put together and lighting systems got put together. And, you know, in the touring world, whether it's comedy or whatever, it doesn't matter. The same guys are building the same stages. The same guys are plugging in the same lights. They're plugging in the same PA systems.
What do you mean with the same guy? Like,
like roadies are roadies. It doesn't matter who's standing on the stage. The stage still needs to get built.
Right, right.
So whether you're, you know, whether you're building a stage for a rock concert or whoever, eventually these guys that work for these companies and girls too, they end up just moving around a lot and working for different companies. So eventually at the radio station on the street team, tours would come through and, you know, there'd be a staging guy or a lighting guy that came through 3 months ago with a different band. And he'd be like, oh, well, if you're going to give me my pick of, you know, these kids from the radio station, I'll take the purple haired girl because she worked with me 3 months ago and I know she knows what she's doing. So I started learning how to put together PAs and lighting rigs and, you know, trussing systems and all of that kind of stuff. And I loved it. And so one of them said to me one day, you know, you work really hard, because that's one of the things I got from my grandfather and my parents is I have an overactive work ethic. Like, I got to be moving all the time.
Yeah, well, you have energy. Just talking to you, I have to take a nap after I talk to you.
So he was like, what's the radio station paying you? And I was like, I don't know. We make minimum wage. It's like $4 an hour or whatever.
Jeez.
And he was like, really, if you worked on a crew, you'd make $10 an hour doing the same stuff, humping the same gear, running the same
cables.
Because
of the union and everything.
Not even union, but just that was like the industry minimum. That was the industry standard back then. So I was like, really? I can make $10 an hour, like plugging in PAs and stuff? He was like, yeah. So I got put on a list of like local laborers. So when tours would come through Boston and Massachusetts, they would hire a certain amount of stagehands. And so I started doing that as another part-time job while I was working at the radio station and at Spencer Gifts. And so I had like the 3 craziest jobs in the world. And eventually the roadieing stuff started like taking over. And
but
I started
But you weren't able to travel as a roadie. You were sort of a local roadie for
I was doing it locally, and there was a staging company based out of Springfield, Mass that had their main office in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I used to build their stages a lot, and they were like, you know, if you came to work for us directly, you'd make more money. Do you know how to drive a truck? And you're like, yeah, I can do that, whatever. So I started working just for the staging company, and this was during the Clinton administration, and he was from Little Rock. So this staging company got all of President Clinton's speaking engagement staging business. So I actually built stages for President Clinton.
Oh, you did?
And, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he was like the commencement speaker up at Dartmouth and at UConn, and I have a picture of me in front of Marine One. Like,
wow.
It's just bizarre.
So, you were like, were you the second Monica Lewinsky that we didn't know anything about it?
No. I was like the sweaty roadie girl, not, you know, The girl in the blue dress.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So I started driving trucks and building stages. And so I would travel around the Northeast mostly, but I would go down to Little Rock every now and again or whatever. And then when I came back, I would tell the radio station, all right, I'm going to be home for 2 weeks. You can schedule me to do whatever the hell you want. And then I would go back out and do staging gigs. And they were like, well, if you learn how to drive the bigger trucks, we'll give you a raise. So then I started driving semis and started doing all of that. Jeez. I mean, it's nuts.
I got to tell you, I'm getting a little aroused. You know, you driving a semi, that red, that crazy purple hair of yours.
They'd hear me on the CB and they'd be like, is that a lady truck I hear? Come on back now. And I'd be like, yeah. And they're like, what do they call you, darling? And they started calling me Barney because I had purple hair. So you're purple like the dinosaur, baby. It's weird.
I'm sure they all wanted to meet up at a roadside stop.
Like,
right?
I was a lot lizard or something, you know?
A lot lizard.
That's what they call those girls.
I didn't know that.
Yes, that's what they call them. The girls that hang out in the big truck stops and stuff. Yeah, they call them lot lizards.
There's two things I learned that I like. Lot lizard and when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I love that.
Right?
I never
it's
heard
the
that
truth.
Before.
I don't know whose phrase that is. I'm stealing it. I feel bad that I can't give them credit for it, but I think the saying is so good.
Probably a carpenter. I think Jesus said it. So now you're driving semis and...
So I'm driving semis and building stages, but I still stayed at the radio station because I felt like there was just a reason why. And at that point, Opie and Anthony had started at AAF.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They used to go on that show. Yeah, well, they started at AAF together, and they took the city by storm.
Yeah.
And so because I was on the street team and I used to go in the studio and help them out or whatever, I worked with those guys. And once they started really getting ratings, they were going to hire them a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, Howard Stern's got Robin. Opie and Anthony should have a female producer. So I talked to him about it and they were like, you should totally apply. So I had to put a demo tape together of like my editing skills because I thought, again, I'm going to be behind the scenes. So this is like my editing skills and whatever. But I didn't have anybody else to use, so I used my own voice. And I was doing these really bad impressions and, like, just trying to be funny, and it was sad. Yeah. I have the demo somewhere. I got
to
find it.
Yeah, but you just... But it takes time to grow into what you did, which is to just be you. You're so original and funny just talking. But when you start out trying to be funny, you feel uncomfortable trying... You don't feel like you can just be yourself, that it's funny enough, right? So you're trying...
Yeah,
right.
Well, I would think like a stand-up, like the pressure of getting behind a microphone is the same, whether you're in front of people or in a studio. It's the same thing. You feel like you're supposed to be playing a character or you're supposed to become something other than yourself. And it takes a while to realize that the reason why you're behind the mic is because of who you are, not because who they think you're going to be when you get there.
Right, right. But you need someone to be able to... above you who's experienced to see the potential in you that you can get to that place.
Yeah, and I did not see that in myself at all.
But
like
did
I said,
else?
I thought yeah, so I applied for the job and I had a meeting with the program director. I gave him my demo and by then I had been at the radio station like 7.5 years.
Wow.
I had done every job, I had gotten everybody coffee, I'd run every errand.
So in your mid twenties now?
Yeah.
Wow.
This was 1998.
Wow. Did you have time to date? Were you dating at all?
Yeah, oh yeah. If there was an asshole within 50-mile radius of my direct location, I dated him. Oh, absolutely.
You're one of those? You attract assholes?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I don't
yeah,
see
I'm
that
because
you're very secure and...
Yeah, but you know what the problem is? And it took me a long time to realize it.
Hmm.
Guys would look at me like that horse that everybody else says couldn't be trained. And so they'd be like, I'm going to be the one to get a saddle on it and I'm going to be the one to ride it. And it took me a while, but eventually I'd figure out what they were doing and I'd kick them off.
Because they're trying to control you.
Yeah.
And the best thing to do with you is to sort of give you a wide berth, let you be.
Just let me be me.
You got a meat slicer and a hammer and don't fuck with her.
Yeah, and if you're man enough to be able to handle that, cool.
Right.
But most guys can't.
Right. Yeah,
which is fine, but just don't try to date me. Like, you're not going to... I've come to the point in my life, you're not going to change anybody.
Oh, no. No.
So... Don't try to change me.
Yeah, no, it's never, yeah. It's so funny, yeah. And people, but you're right. There aren't a lot of guys that are secure enough to be able
to. It takes a strong guy.
Right. So you're dating, whatever, and you did the thing. And then,
yeah, and I'm doing the thing. So I get called into the office, and I'm hoping they're going to tell me you're Opie and Anthony's new producer, which would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically get told that I didn't have enough production experience. Was a total punch in the gut, because that's what I got into it in the first place for, was because I thought I was going to be this production person on the behind the scenes.
Right.
And I was like, you know, that's it. I've been here 7.5 years. I can make way more money as a roadie. I'll just put a wrench in my pocket. I'll go do that work. I like that work, whatever. And so the program director said, have you ever thought about being a DJ? And I swear to God, this is what happened. I looked at him and I go, really? What am I going to do? Go on the air and be like, hi, my name's Carrie and I'm going to play you songs. I was like, no, I'm not. No. And he was like, well, I'm really sorry, you know, that you feel that way and whatever. And I was like,
Why did you say no?
Because I never imagined myself being the one behind the microphone. I always imagined myself working for the people behind the microphone.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I go walking down the hall into the studio and Opie and Anthony were there. And this is some of the most sound career advice I ever got from anybody. And I am friends with Opie to this day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And me too. And give Anthony him credit too, yeah. to this. Yeah. And Anthony too.
Mm. I go on Anthony's show a lot. He's got.
Have you been to the compound?
Yeah.
Are you heavily armed when you go there?
Oh God, it's like. And then he's got a studio now in New York City where he does his podcast.
Oh, cool.
And like video, he's videotaped and goes online in real time. But yeah. Good guy.
Yeah. Those guys are awesome. And they have never been anything but amazing to me. Mm-hmm. And so I went down the hall and they were like, did you get the job? And I'm fairly certain they knew I wasn't getting the job because they had a say in who their producer was going to be.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I didn't get it. And I said, but they, you know, they asked if I ever wanted to be a DJ. And Opie looked right at me and he goes, well, what did you say? And I said, I told him no. Like, why would I want to do that? And Opie looked at me in all seriousness and he goes, are you fucking stupid? And he goes, this is one of the biggest, most influential rock stations in the entire country and one of the biggest media markets. There are hundreds of people that send their demos into this radio station to that guy's office that you just walked out of trying to get a job here. And that guy just basically offered you one and you turned it down. What is wrong with you? Turn around, swallow your pride, walk back down there and say, yes.
Yeah.
To whatever you want me to do, yes, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that in that moment I listened to him.
Oh, you did it.
I did it. And wow. I turned around and I went back down the hall and I said to the program director, this guy, Dave Douglas at the time, I said, I'm really sorry I reacted that way. I was just really bummed out that I wanted that job so bad. But you know me, I've been here for years. If there's anything I can ever do, of course, you know, I'm never going to say no to an opportunity from you. So I'm sorry if you thought I was rude. And it just so happened that like a few weeks later, one of the girls that worked part time on the weekends, like really early in the morning, she like locked herself out of the studio and the station went off the air and this was before cell phones.
She flipped out?
She went to the bathroom and got locked out and she didn't know what to do. Oh, and the station went off the air, so they fired her.
Wow.
And so they called me and they were like, we want to give you a shot on the air. We're going to put you on the weekends and see what happens.
If you can't beat that situation out, you're just going to be able to go to the bathroom without locking yourself outside a door.
Right?
You should be able to keep your job forever.
So I'm like, I can go to the bathroom and not lock myself out of the studio. Check, skill, mastered. So I started working on the air like in the overnights and like early on the weekends. And I did that for like a couple months. So I probably did like 8 or 9 shows. And then Opie and Anthony did this famous bit in Boston where they went on the air on April Fool's Day and said that the mayor had died in Florida in a car accident. And the longtime mayor of Boston at the time, like, you didn't piss him off. And everybody got all freaked out. And Opie and Anthony ended up getting fired. Now, them getting fired was the best thing that ever happened to them because they ended up in New York and they ended up syndicated and all of that stuff. But because they got fired, they took the guy that was working nights at the time at AAF and put him in afternoons. And they needed a night jock. And we didn't have a full-time woman on the air. And I guess they had been looking for one. But they couldn't find somebody that got all of like the Boston references and the jokes and had the attitude, that knew the music, that knew the station. And so they were like, we're going to throw you on the air at night and we're just going to see what happens.
Wow.
And so they put me.
Now, were you nervous at that point about that?
I didn't know I should be nervous. That's how naive I was. Like, I didn't know what I didn't know. So I was just like, all right, I'm a rock roadie. They're giving me this shot. It's probably not going to go anywhere, but I'm going to do it. So they threw me on the air at night, and basically the first night that I walked in there, the program director walked me down the hallway and basically said, figure it out, kid, and pushed me in the studio. And they loved the fact that I didn't know what I was doing because it was raw.
Yeah, it wasn't going to be another polished from...
They knew I knew the music. They knew I knew all the bands and all the roadies because of what I did. I had been around the station for years, so I knew everybody at the station. So, I mean, there was a point where I had like porn stars on my show having sex with listeners live on the radio. And like, it was insane. And I look back at it now and I'm like, how did I not get fired? Like, how did I not have been prison?
And they weren't, it was all like, were you sort of being influenced by what Howard Stern was doing at the time?
No, because I didn't even, first of all, I grew up in the suburbs. So like the big rock station in Boston at the time, I never even grew up listening to them because I grew up in the suburbs. So I grew up listening to AAF.
Oh, okay.
And I studied radio and, you know, I knew who Howard Stern was, but I spent so much of my time involved in my own crap. I learned about him in school because of, like, you know, the ethics and the laws of slander and libel and obscenity. And I mean, obviously, he was a case study for every college kid studying radio at the time.
Right.
But like, I didn't listen to him. I don't think I had a way to listen to him at the time. He wasn't in Boston at the time. And then when he finally got syndicated into Boston, he got syndicated at night. So he was on the air in the morning, and then I was his competition, but he was pre-recorded.
Oh, okay.
So I just was like, they just told me, just do what you do. So I had the bands calling my show drunk in the middle of the night, and Ozfest would get out, and the tour buses would pull up to the radio station with groupies and drugs and coolers full of beer. And
so that,
and
all
I just
of that
did
is,
whatever came true to mind. Yeah.
And but you were able to stay out of actually doing the drugs and getting crazy with that stuff and sort of
I mean, there was a time. Yeah. All right. I smoked pot.
Yeah. No,
I did a lot of my partying when I was in high school because I was bored.
I grew up
in a small town in the suburbs, so like that's when I partied the most, I think, was when I was in high school.
That's pretty good, because sometimes if you party that much in high school, then you some people go the other way, and it's like, oh, I need more interesting drugs, and then it becomes like a bigger drug problem.
Yeah, no, I don't have that kind of, I'm addicted to like
bologna,
carbs and cheese.
Marzadella.
Yeah. Like pasta, rice, bread, and cheese. I can't give those up.
So
but
any guy out
have,
there that wants to date you, just show up with some cheese and pasta.
Yeah, show up with a giant wheel of imported sharp provolone cheese, and my heart is yours.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you look like. So now you feel like you're in a groove and you know what you're doing, and this sort of takes off, right?
Yeah, it started taking off, and I didn't know how much it had taken off. I didn't, because I wasn't even looking at the ratings.
You walked around with your head up your ass for 30
years?
No, but
I
just... How do you not know anything's going on around
We weren't in a digital age at that point.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Ratings were still getting printed in books at that point.
Yeah, Twitter and all that.
Yeah, all of that didn't exist.
Yeah,
the internet had just shown up. We had one computer for the entire radio station.
Jesus.
So at that time, it was still, you know, I was still having a hard time believing that people wanted to listen to my show.
Wow.
Never mind that my ratings were good.
But you were doing what was successful is you were doing what was entertaining to you, and therefore it was unique. And then you found like-minded listeners.
Yeah.
And that's the classic.
That's where the name came from. The listeners gave me the name Mistress Carrie because I was on the air every night and I was talking about sex and like whatever. And they used to call and be like, you're the other woman in my life. I spend every night with you. My wife knows about it. It's like I have a mistress and she's cool with it.
Would you ever give advice? Would they ask you for advice?
Yeah, they would call and be like, what are you thinking? I'd be like, you know, stop being an asshole. Like, pick up your socks.
Exactly.
It's not hard.
Exactly.
It really isn't that hard keeping women happy.
Just clear the plate and put it in the dishwasher. Just
put the friggin' seat down. Help out a little bit. Are you kidding me?
Oh, my God.
It doesn't take that much. And so I just found this groove, and then I got a call one night on the request line from a program director at a bigger rock station in a bigger market asking if I was under contract.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, how the hell do you even know who I am? You're not in Boston. Mm. And he was like, have you not looked at your ratings? And I was like, nope. So the next day I went into my boss's office, like the big boss, and I was chewing bubble gum and twirling my hair because I was just trying to, you know, I was like, you're going to fall for the girl thing. All right, I'll give you the girl thing. Because at that point I felt like I was being kept in the dark. You know what I mean? That they didn't want to tell me I was successful.
Oh, okay.
So I walked in and I was like, you are not going to believe what happened. I totally got offered a job last night at a bigger station in a bigger market. Isn't that amazing? And I had a contract the next day.
Oh, you didn't have a contract?
No, I was working by the hour back then. I was canceling roadie gigs going. I mean, this all happened in like the span of like 6 months.
How much an hour were they paying you?
I think at the time I was making 10 to start.
Oh, my God. What a steal.
And then I started making like $15 an hour. Then they put me on salary. But I wasn't under contract. And I think my first contract was like $25,000 a year. And I was working six shifts a week and, you know, doing all of this other stuff. But I didn't know what I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not like they're going to sit down and be like, you know, your ratings are through the roof and you're worth all this money. Like, plus, nobody in this business is going to tell you that.
There's big time misogyny too with that, especially in that era of like, you know, oh, she's a girl. We'll just whatever, you know.
I'm sure guys are being treated differently. Yeah, and I didn't have any experience. So I really didn't feel like, other than the ratings I didn't know I had no leverage to go in and demand anything. Mm-hmm. I was happy that I had an email address and, you know, that I had the job I had because it was manually easy. I wasn't in the bakery at 2 o'clock in the morning. I wasn't lifting staging equipment. Like, let's be honest, being a radio DJ isn't physically taxing. I was like, you're paying me to do this? Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
So once I got the contract, I was like, oh my God, I think this is like real. Like, this is, this is my job.
Now you've got to start to change your attitude. Like, but it didn't affect your performance or you, what you were doing.
No, I just was like, okay, you know, I finally gave up the other jobs.
Yeah.
Retired from my roadie career or whatever.
Man, I can't believe you did that. You hung up your hat. You hung up your CD.
I did. I got rid of my crescent wrench. I took the Leatherman off my belt. And
so how has it changed? Like, you know, how has radio changed because the music industry has changed so drastically?
God.
Like, what is it like now compared to what it was then for you, especially someone who's been at one station and you're the music director?
Because it was like the Wild West back then.
Meaning what? Not just the partying, but like you would make or break stars by playing stations like yours that were huge and large markets would make or break bands and artists by playing their music, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen anymore on radio because it's all coming through iTunes and Spotify and everything else.
Yeah, or just, you know, bands having the opportunity to just have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, these people that, you know, nobody knew about yesterday are, you know, this viral sensation. And next thing you know, a record company or whatever is going to them and, you know, or they're putting up their own music on the internet for purchase or whatever. The whole industry has changed. We're not there so much to be the outlet to showcase the new stuff now as much as we're there to be the mood medium that they come to us for.
What do you mean by mood medium?
Well, I mean, you know,
you just want to, if
you're living your life and you're in the mood for rock music, so you come to AAF, you know you're going to get rock music.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And, you know, you're going to get some classic stuff, then you're going to get, you know, maybe some grunge or some alternative stuff, and you'll get some new stuff. But I'm coming to you because even with the new music, everybody thought, oh, with the internet, you know, the record labels will be gone and, you know, it'll be open to everybody. But all it did was give everybody the same playing field. There's a lot of crappy music out there, and you need a way to filter it all out to find the best stuff.
So you're saying radio stations are still relevant in terms of helping somebody break because there's so much on the internet now and a lot of it's crap. If it jumps from the internet to radio, that sort of gives it a little bit better, sharper spotlight. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of music fans out there. I mean, there are the diehard music fans like me that were the ones waiting for the record store to open when I was a kid so I could buy the album the day it came out. The ones that are searching the internet for the new music and doing all of that stuff. But there's a lot of passive music fans. They love it, but they have a job.
Yeah.
And they love it, but they have kids and they have a house and whatever. So they know when they turn on our radio station that they're going to get this wide variety of stuff we know they like, rock music, and that the new stuff that makes it through the filter, not, you know, it's not an exact science, but, you know, more often than not, if we're giving them a new song, they're probably going to like it.
Yeah, well, but it's really more complicated for you guys than it was back then now with all these other playing fields and everything else. Right? It's got to be for radio.
Yeah, and I think
how to stay relevant.
Yeah, and the definition of, like, back then, like, there could be a rock station for, like, every genre of, like, rock.
Yeah, I can remember, like, WAF was straight rock, and then there would be
like hard rock, heavy metal, right, and then there was more like alternative light, classic.
And then there was like light pop, and then there was like, you know, like George Michael or whatever. Like, yeah, there was like a, yeah. And
like when I grew up, what you listened to defined who you were.
Yep.
So growing up, I was listening to like Iron Maiden and Judas Priest and Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses. And I would look at the kids listening to like U2 and INXS and be like, ugh. And now, you know, you have to give people credit. If you grab somebody's iPhone, you're going to find all kinds of stuff in there. If you went through mine, you're not just going to find, you know, Led Zeppelin and, you know, Disturbed records. There's going to be a ton of stuff in there that is outside the format.
You'll see teenagers today with Aerosmith and Metallica and then, you know, hip hop and like everything. Yeah.
I think more so open-minded, so what we can play as far as what's considered rock music, it's a pretty wide spectrum of stuff that you can consider rock music. And there's a lot of really cool rock music out there. It's just there's so much crap too.
Yeah. Because
so part of my job as the music director is to sift through the crap.
So are you going online and listening and picking just randomly? Or are you having stuff brought to you all the time?
No, the record companies bring us stuff. I mean, we're always going online and kind of checking stuff out. The audience will tip us off to stuff that they find. Yeah. And, you know, you go to shows and you're there for the headliner, but the three opening acts you've never heard of, you want to get there early and check them out. That's part of my job that I still love.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about, you went to Iraq. You were the first non-news journalist embedded with the U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, right?
Yeah.
Very
proud of that.
But you talk about in a documentary that the soldiers were a little sort of like keeping their distance initially because they didn't know if they were to take you seriously or if you were just, you know, there as being like a shock jock or whatever. So how did you finally come to sort of win their confidence over and sort of like them accept you and what did you do? Did you just sleep with all of them? Which I wouldn't.
No, that was not my patriotic duty. But well, the other half of my family. So there's the Italian side of the bakery, and the other half of my family goes so far back in America that we don't even know exactly when they got here. And that is my mom's side. And my grandfather was in the Navy in World War II in Korea. His father fought in World War I in the Army. My dad's best friend growing up. Got drafted and went to Vietnam as a paratrooper and has a Purple Heart.
Wow.
So I was just always brought up. My dad was a firefighter as well as a baker. My mom was a nurse. So I was always brought up with huge respect for military service, first responder service, anyone that put a uniform on in service to their country and fellow man. I was brought up to be, you know, very respectful of that, to the point where when I was a roadie and didn't think this AAF thing was going to work on the radio, I was contemplating and started studying for the civil service test in Massachusetts to go be a firefighter with my dad.
Wow.
Because the bakery at that point had, you know, already kind of gone away and closed. So,
you knew how to deal with hot things. So,
so you know, when 9/11 happened, you know, everybody knew the world had changed. And my generation grew up, for the most part, you know, minor conflicts, but nothing like a full-scale war like my parents' generation.
Right.
And so I used to hear stories about, you know, my uncle that came home from Vietnam and was getting spit on at the airport and all that. And I was just like, I always used to say to my parents, you know, my generation would never do that. You know, the snotty kid. If we ever went to war, our generation wouldn't spit on the troops the way that yours did. Your generation sucked and blah, 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 whatever. And so when 9/11 happened, we knew right away. And, you know, we're a rock station. So it's probably 2/3 guys at least. All the branches of the military run commercials and whatever, trying to recruit.
So and, you decide you're going to go over there and do something. You're going
to. I had started doing stuff even before the trip, just getting involved with the troops here. I started a big care package drive, and we had like support the troops rallies and all of this kind of stuff when the war first started. So then guys started going overseas, getting my care packages and sending me stuff back, sending me pictures back. They would send me pictures of like my bumper stickers on Humvees going on patrols and all of this stuff. And then the USO started sending people over there. And so they were like, well, you know, they would send me a letter and say, well, Mr. Scarry, you know, how come the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders can be over here? Why don't you come over here? So I looked into it. And the USO, you know, they want to be as broad and mass appeal as they can be because you don't know where these service members are from. They could be from Alaska or Miami. You just don't know.
Yeah.
So they said, you know, you're regionally recognizable, but you're not really nationally recognizable. And so I had been emailing back and forth with some people that, you know, were listeners of the show. And I had a guy that worked at CENTCOM in Baghdad, and I was like, you know, how could I get over there? The guys are asking me to come over. How could I get over there? And he was like, well, technically, you work in the media. So technically, you're a reporter. So I'll send you the embed packet and you fill it out, but put your real name instead of Mistress Carrie and put.
Why does a hooker want to come over to Iran?
Why does this dominatrix want to come over to the Middle East? And so, and they were like, and put the parent company of WAF, Entercom Communications, instead of WAF, fill it all out, send it back to me, and I'll send it to the Pentagon and we'll see if we can get it to fly. So this was sometime, I don't know, towards the end of 2004, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I start running around the office telling everybody, hey, you know, I'm starting the process. I want to go overseas and, you know, broadcast with the troops. And everybody was like, oh, yeah, you know, okay, good luck. It was like a little kid running up to you going, I'm going to flap my arms really hard and jump off the roof and I see if I can fly. Like, oh, okay, kid, you know, the door to the door to the roof is locked, right? Okay, good. Then she's fine. Let her flap her arms until she gets tired. So he started pushing this, and I still to this day don't know who signed off on it, but it took a little over a year.
Yeah.
And it got signed off on. And they were like, you need to figure out how you're going to get over here.
So you end up over there, and what happened?
So I end up over there. And so the guys had to, any unit that takes on an embedded reporter from anywhere, they have to take on that responsibility. And when I went to Iraq in 2006, that's when they were really like kidnapping journalists and executing them on the internet.
So
and
you had to, they had
so
to take
So I was
care
a liability. Yeah. And these units that I was going over to be with were all from Massachusetts. So they knew who I was were like, hell yeah, Mistress Carrie's coming over. Yeah, we'll take her.
So, so you were traveling there with these guys and you they were taking you out on patrols and stuff?
I flew with medevac units. I went out on convoys.
And were you broadcasting at the time?
Yeah.
Like back? At, like, what were you like taping stuff and sending it? And then
I had a recorder because I couldn't, you know, there was an 8-hour time change. I think it was 8 hours. So I would record stuff and when the internet allowed, send it back. And then I had a sat phone. So I could go live on a sat phone.
Oh, wow.
Which was like $4 a minute or something. We had to get all this money to pay for the satellite phone and the
Why
cameras
is there a $6,000 bill? I was talking to my grandma. She was giving me a new recipe for lasagna. On the sat phone?
Yeah, you know, whatever. We're just shooting the shit. So I get over there and I told the guys, I was like, listen, I'm here not only to tell your story, but also to bring back the stories of, you know, where you come from and your families, to tell you that we're thinking about you and that you're loved. And I want to be able to go home and tell people, because we had all heard the stories back then of, you know, they're baby killers or they don't have any body armor and the military is not giving them what they need to do the missions. And, you know, I started calling people in the military going, do these guys not have body armor? Because you're advertising to recruit on my show. And I feel like now I'm sending them to a meat grinder and they don't have what they need.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like, well, go over there and see for yourself then. And so I basically had the ability to report what I saw, whether it was good or bad for the military. Yeah. The only thing they said was, don't pull a Geraldo and like draw the battle plan in the sand on live TV and give up like classified troop movements.
Yes, I got ahead of the troops and I'm here at this building.
Yeah. So they were like, don't do that. But otherwise, we can't tell you what to say. You're a journalist.
So you would just send stuff. Oh, that's amazing. And that guy probably really trusted you. And that's how you kind of embraced you. And like,
I wanted to know that, you know, I wanted people back home to know, because these were National Guard guys. So these are guys that have a job back home and a family and a life.
Yeah.
And they left it all to go and go overseas and put themselves in harm's way on our behalf.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be able to tell people what that was like for them, and then to be able to come home
and talk
and make sure that someone was advocating on their behalf when they got home.
Yeah, so people,
because all of the post-traumatic stress stories were coming out and the veteran suicide rates were going up and the guys were having a hard time finding jobs when they got back. So
so you were using your celebrity to help these people transition back, which is great, you know, because
I wanted to give them a voice that wasn't skewered. You know, everybody talks about fake news now or whatever, but even back then, I want, you know, the people that listen to my show know that I'm just going to tell them how it
straight
is.
Straight up. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I was very critical of, you know, the companies and how rich they were getting off the war, how much they were charging the government for the food in the chow halls and
the station,
you know,
never,
that kind
the
of
station
stuff.
The station never shut you down on that kind of conversation because, you know,
they
start sponsors or whatever.
No. Awesome. Nope, not at all. Not at all. And so once I got back from Iraq, and started doing more stuff with the military, all the guys immediately were like, yo, you went to Iraq, but you're not going to come to Afghanistan?
Oh, wow. So they wanted you. Yeah.
Yeah. So what took me a year and a half to get approved for Iraq took me 18 hours to get approved for Afghanistan.
Wow. So guys around the world, that guys around the world wanted you coming to see them. That's amazing.
Yeah. I was honored. And when I was in Iraq, I traveled around every few days. I you know, was with a different unit. But when I was in Afghanistan, I was with the same infantry unit for 3 weeks straight. Wow. So I went on missions with them. I was in their convoys. We were together 24 hours a day. And at the time, women weren't allowed in the infantry. I was a member of the media.
Yeah, there's great pictures of you online and everything. And were you married at the time? I mean, I know you're...
I was dating the guy that I married when I went to Iraq.
Right. But you're not married now.
No, I am happily divorced.
What happened?
How long is this podcast?
You give me the short version.
The short version is I found out that my entire marriage was a lie.
Wow.
Without really coming across as insensitive or bad-mouthing anyone, we can just say that I have great sympathy for Kris Jenner.
Oh, wow. Okay. It was that situation.
And
you were married how long?
8 years. We were together for 10. Yeah.
And the whole time there was that situation?
I didn't know anything. I was basically the person that was, I don't know, a perceived cure in some way that maybe getting married and having kids would make everything cool and normal. And so I get really mad when people talk about, you know, keeping, you know, gays, lesbians, transgender people in the closet. Why don't you just, you know, just act normal and marry a woman and whatever. Well, okay, yeah, fine. You push those people to try and act straight, and you know what they do? They marry people like me.
Right, and then they...
And then what happens?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the collateral damage.
Right, right.
So I kind of uncovered, you know, this whole lie on my own because I thought something was going on. I didn't really know what it was. And I finally figured out what it was, like my whole world, you know, this all just happened last year.
Jesus.
Yeah, so now the divorce is done, and, you know, I'm moving on, and...
And did you?
I can't change it.
Yeah. And did you? Were you trying to have a kid, or like you were talking about having a kid?
Yeah. I mean, we got married later in life. I was so career driven, and it took me a while to, you know, I want to make sure because, like I said, I dated every asshole on the planet that I was marrying the right guy. So I waited until I was 36 to get married, and then
your
I went
dresses
to Iraq
are missing. And then your fucking bras and dresses are missing. Like, what's going on here? I could swear I had 4 bras. What's going on?
No, it was not. It wasn't like that. There was a separate wardrobe that wasn't mine. But yeah, I went through like 2 years of fertility treatments.
Wow.
And I haven't even talked about this on the air just because it's kind of a buzzkill on the radio in between a Led Zeppelin and Metallica record.
Okay. Well,
you know,
my podcast is designed to make people suicidal. So that's
awesome. They're perfect. I'm the perfect guest.
No.
But I went through and people didn't, even at the radio station, people didn't know that I was going through fertility. So I'd be giving myself shots while I was at work and people didn't know because I didn't want anybody to know. It's like there's enough pressure. And so I went through, you know, like 4 different rounds and then I got pregnant. I lost a baby.
Oh, wow.
While I was on the air.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, for some reason, everything.
Boy, you'll like, do anything for ratings. Holy
right?
shit.
My gallbladder almost exploded. I almost died on the air. I lost a baby on the air. Yeah, the audience would have no idea. I mean, they're going to know now because they're listening to your podcast.
Oh,
but
my God.
So things went south after I lost the baby.
Oh,
it was like the realization that maybe what you thought was going to happen isn't going to happen now.
Yeah.
And so things were bad for a while, and I tried to figure out what was going on and whatever. And then when I kind of discovered the truth, it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, which kind of sucks because, you know, if somebody's cheating on you with a younger, hotter version of you, you're like, all right, well, I can kind of understand or whatever. Right. But at least in this case, like, there's nothing I could have done to compete.
Yeah, I would actually feel better about this situation than the other situation. Like,
yeah,
I feel,
that's what I mean. It's just completely different. The part is, though, is that you find out that your relationship was never truthful.
Right. And what's fucked up is, and again, not to be insensitive to people who, you know, are in this situation as transgender or whatever, but like you shouldn't, he thinks by, I guess, marrying you, it's going to fix it, right? He's going to stop having that feeling, or it's going to get flushed out of his system or something like
that.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, we don't talk and we haven't really spoken very much at all since, You know, it just is one of those things where it's like, it sucked so bad.
Yeah.
And then when I found out the truth.
Yeah.
I was like, rip the Band-Aid off, move on.
Yeah.
Like now that explains all the crap that I've been going through the last few years.
Oh, all right.
I'm just done. I don't care.
I don't think I ever broke news on my podcast before, but I feel very important right now. So are you dating? Like, you and I think, could date and then marry, but then we'd, like,
well,
kill
each other. Well, aren't you already married?
Other. Yeah, but that doesn't really count. No.
Do you really think that a Sicilian woman and a Sicilian guy should date? Let's be honest. Even people in Sicily would be like, I don't know about that.
No, we'd have, like, passionate sex and then kill each other right after.
Yeah, like, I'd have to look under your pillow for the knife you were going to stab me with when you were done. But we would eat really well.
We'd have like amazing meals, and then it would be a lot of yelling, and then you know, like slamming
things
of
would
doors.
Get broken.
Ba-bongo! And then, be a lot
and
of that.
Then it would be a bloody crime scene.
A bloody crime scene. And then the guys would stand over us and go, "What happened?" And then the guy would go, "They were Sicilian." He goes,
"Yeah."
And they both
don't ask
out.
Questions. Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Right, exactly. That's the murder report. Sicilians, and then they sign it, and it's filed away, and the case is solved within like seconds. So, are you dating now?
Yeah, I'm trying.
How's it going? I should meet these people beforehand.
You should?
Well, you obviously can't sniff out if a guy's wearing fucking dresses behind your back.
Aww.
Let me come in and help you.
Liz, I'll tell you this. I ran a credit check and a background check.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
On a guy?
On my ex before we got married.
Oh,
before we moved in together.
Okay, that's a little psycho, though.
So it's not psycho. I wanted to make sure he was moving into my house.
Oh, all right. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I wanted to make sure if I'm really going to, like, move in with somebody who's the first guy I ever lived with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the first guy I you know, I was going to marry. Like, I wanted to make sure. That I'm not a naive girl. So the fact that I didn't know this whole other thing was going on.
No, I know. I'm just kidding. I'm just
kidding.
So, how are you meeting guys? You going on plenty of kettle of fish or whatever it is?
I would rather gouge my eyes out with a crack spoon than be like swiping left or right.
So, if I dated you, if I dated you, what would I have to do to like impress you?
You would hate your life.
Why?
If you dated me, because obviously I'm a mess.
No, you're not. You're so
track,
cool.
My track record. Yeah, I'm cool. See, that's the problem right there, Paul. I'm cool, right? And you're like, this chick is badass. She's funny and she jumps out of airplanes and she rides motorcycles and goes to war zones and whatever. Then you date me.
Yeah.
And you're like,
are you super controlling?
No, but you'd be like, why can't you just be like Tom's girlfriend?
No, I would want you to be you.
Well, besides the fact that you're married with a kid.
No, I don't mean me. I don't mean me. I mean you in the third person. Like, I'm not talking about me. Like, a guy. If I'm just curious, like, you know, because you have such a dynamic personality.
But it's a big personality.
It is.
And I don't take a lot of crap. And
we'll get your ball
dudes.
Gag. You wear a ball gag every once in a while.
Oh, yeah. Good luck with that. But, like, all my friends are dudes. Like, any guy that's going to be around me is going to have to go through the infantry battalion I was embedded with in Afghanistan. Good luck. If you knew those guys, you'd be like, oof.
That or your Italian relatives.
Right?
And then you got to take them to the Sunday dinner. And I took my wife, and she's your mom's side of the family. They go back, like, Potter is her name. So they go back to, like, early America. So they're Protestant wasps. They're, like, real quiet. And she was, like, first dinner at my house with, like, all the relatives. And she goes, why was everybody mad at each other? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Everybody was yelling at each other. I go, no, we were just talking. That's how we talk. Like,
yeah,
she
that's
get
how
her.
We are. I mean, listen to me. I'm not even mad right now, and I'm yelling at you.
So you got to find the guy that can kind of surf your way. But you're not like emotionally unstable up and down.
No. That's contrary to popular belief, no. No, I work a lot, and it's, you know, like your career. You're away from home a lot.
Yeah.
It's kind of all-encompassing. It takes over your whole life. Even when you're not working, you're working because I'm always looking for stuff to talk about on the show, or I'm going to shows, or I do a lot of charity and veterans outreach work. And so it takes a certain kind of person that's willing to have their own life and be just as passionate about what they do and still be willing to take time away from that. For me to take precious time away from my work and my passions to spend time together.
You need a male. You need a male blow up doll. I think that's.
Yeah, right.
I think that fits all of your parameters.
One of those creepy real dolls that's like $8,000, and you could custom order it.
Oh God, no!
It's a tough order. And the thing is, like now, you know, if I'm going to find any kind of silver lining out of everything that I've gone through, it's like, there's no pressure for me to have kids.
Right.
I've already been married, so it's not like there's this pressure for me to walk down the aisle anymore or whatever. So it's like I have this career that I love.
Yeah.
And I have amazing friends and family and, you know, I have all of these passions in my life. So would it be great to be able to share it with somebody? Yeah. Absolutely. But it's going to be the right person.
Yeah, and you'll meet somebody who's moved along in their life, too, and already had kids and whatever. So, like, a lot of that complicated stuff is behind you, you know?
Yeah, I'm looking at the world in a very different place than I was 10 or 11 years ago. Back then, you know, when you're younger, you have these, like, I had rules. Like, I'll never date anybody that's married. I'll never date anybody that has kids. I'll never date anybody that this. Never date any. I was like, I broke up with a guy because he didn't believe in fossils.
Are you out of your fucking mind?
No, I didn't know the guy was, like, a full-blown creationist. We had been dating for like almost a year. P.S. He wasn't going to church every Sunday and he sure as hell wasn't abstinent. And then we're watching TV one night and it was about like fossils, right?
Yeah.
I think we can all pretty much agree that they're real at this point unless, you know.
Right.
And he like laughed and I was like, that's not funny. They're talking about like dinosaur bones and stuff. Yeah. You know what I mean? And he was like, you don't really believe that crap, do you? Now, this was years ago. This isn't recent. This was years ago.
Right.
And I go, crap, like fossils and evolution crap? Like, what do you mean crap? And he was like, yeah. And I go, what? Like, what do you believe then? And he was like, you know, 7 days, God, you know, the earth, like whatever. And I was like, you don't believe in fossils. And he was one of those people, he believed the earth was as old as the Bible says. So, you know, humans were riding dinosaurs. Listen, I'm not here to bash your religion.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, if you're willing to put faith enough in scientists to do DNA testing to kill somebody on death row, then let them carbon date the goddamn fossils.
Yeah.
And when they tell you they're 100,000 years old, believe them, because you're willing to put someone to death for the same scientist's word that their DNA was in the study with the candlestick. And so I found myself yelling, fossils! You don't believe in fucking fossils! I'm like screaming at him. So it's like, you know, now I get all that stuff out of the way. You know what I mean?
So you would this time around, if you met a guy who didn't believe in fossils, you'd be like, all right, I can live
with that. I can't.
That.
I'm not going to change. No, I'd be like, we're not even going to date one time.
So this guy probably doesn't believe in global warming either.
I don't know. I haven't talked to him in years, but it took 9 months to find out he didn't believe in fossils.
See, you got to.
That's like a coffee conversation now.
Yeah,
I love you.
How
you doing?
Listen, I love you, but your barometer for a man wanting to be a woman and a guy that doesn't believe in fossils, not good at all. Like,
no, I know.
I could pick up a fossil hater like a mile away. No, I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, so what I've learned is you got to get the hard questions out first.
All right, okay.
Hi, how you doing? My name's Carrie. Yeah? Do you believe in fossils? Do you have a stockpile of dildos I don't know about? Are you wearing dresses? No? All right, cool. Then let's sit down and talk about music or something. But if you can't get past those initial questions.
But you'd be great for speed dating because it's very quick.
Oh, it would be perfect.
But then everybody would be like, who's the freak in the purple hair who's asking these questions?
Yeah. And they're not like the normal dating questions. But seriously, wouldn't you rather know minute one if the person believes in fossils or not?
Yeah.
And not waste 9 months of your life until you find out and you're like, I had sex with the fossil denier. Are you kidding me?
You feel dirty.
Yeah. Like,
you had to go take a shower.
And that was part of what threw me for a loop is I was like, dude, you're not in church on Sunday. You're here having sex with me, but you're so holier than thou that you don't believe in fossils. Whoa.
Jesus.
So the dating thing, you know, I didn't have good luck with it before. I thought I got it right. I loved being married. I was good at it.
Yeah.
That didn't go well. So I'm on the rebound, but with fresh eyes.
All right.
Looking at the world in a different way. So who knows?
All right. Anybody out there that believes in fossils and doesn't have dildos, I want you to email me through my website. You're going to get my friend Carrie hooked up with the right guy.
Oh, yeah, that's what I need. I need Paul Mercurio.
I can fix
as
anything.
My dating consultant. That's what I need.
Oh, my God. I love you. You're
man.
Too much.
Are you kidding me?
You're on WAAF in Boston. Tell
10 to 3 10 every
to
3. Weekday.
Fantastic
on middays.
Show. You can't tell from listening to Carrie on my show that you have to listen to her show. Can they hear it online, too?
Yeah, you can stream us online at WAAF.com.
Okay.
And we also have a free app, and you can listen to us for free through our app anywhere.
All right. And then
And I host my own podcast, which you were on last week.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And a lot
Mistress Carey's,
people were saying a lot of cool things about that. It was so great. Yeah, on Twitter and stuff like that.
Mistress Carey's side piece. You could check it out on iTunes and Google Play.
I was her side piece, everybody.
You were one of my side pieces. Yeah. Get in line.
And when I come to Boston again, we got to hang out.
Oh, yeah. That's the funny thing, is that you and I have talked a bunch of times. Mm. We've never met.
Yeah. Exactly.
We just talk all the time. So
that's
you and
why
I gotta go out partying.
I feel like you're like my sister, like that I never knew, because like, it's rare that you meet somebody that you feel like, oh, I just talked to her last week for an, like, it's very rare for me anyway that you meet somebody that you just instant like chemistry, bang, you know.
And it's not like I'm in an igloo in Alaska somewhere. Like, I'm in the middle of downtown Boston. How have we not met?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm in New York, so it's like,
yeah, exactly.
All right, we're gonna meet. We're gonna come. We're gonna hang out. And then on that night we hang out, I'm going to find you a guy.
Oh, God.
And I will go through the paces. And then
you're going to be the interviewer?
You'll start the date, and I will walk you through the stages of the dating. And then I will actually do the ceremony, and I'll do audience.
Are you going to have sex with him, too? Because I can just say home and eat popcorn, and you can just tell me how they were.
I'll let you know how it is. I'll definitely cup his balls at least.
Thanks for jumping on that grenade for me. I appreciate it.
All right.
Can I tell you how weird it is to be on this side of an interview, by the way?
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah.
You're
it's
great.
Just weird.
You're fantastic.
It's just weird having you ask me questions.
Yeah, well, I mean,
I feel rude that I'm not asking you questions.
No, because
it's your podcast.
Yeah, and you're great. You just talk about your life and you're honest and it was funny and interesting and you have an interesting story and your way your marriage broke up. This is exactly why I love to do the long form interviews, because you can't, there's not enough time in 5 or 10 minutes or even 15 minutes. And just how, you know, that at a childhood, like, you knew you wanted to be a producer in radio. Like, I've never met anybody like that. You know, that you believe in fossils. You're a freak. You're a freak. And you have a cutter, a meat cutter, a meat slicer. And
I got a meat slicer in the kitchen. Why is that so weird?
That should be. No, I love it.
Everybody wants one. Don't deny it.
Exactly.
They do.
Exactly. If you want a girl with a meat slicer, I got someone for you.
And last time we talked, you were like, you should do stand-up and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, God,
So then I talked to my mom, right? Mm-hmm. And she was like, oh, hey, honey, how was your day? You know, whatever. And I was like, oh, you know, did this interview with a stand-up comedian. He told me I should be a stand-up comic. You know what she goes? Mm. My mom goes, oh, yeah, that's what you need.
There you go. Guess you got to listen to your mom.
That's what you need to do.
She's wrong. She's wrong. You got
to
do
it. That's what you need to do, Carrie. Oh, God.
All right. Well, listen, we're going to do another one of these and just talk about like what's going on in the world, because you're so funny and smart.
Don't even get me going.
WAAF.
I'm a doomsday prepper. I told you.
Oh, my God.
I'm in the basement stockpiling food for the zombies.
Freeze-dried figs and stuff like that.
Yes, I do.
Oh, my God. You're so funny. All right. I'm going to definitely get you, in the meantime, a blow-up doll.
That's great.
Between in the thing.
Can he be hot?
It'll be hot. He'll be like a military uniform. How about that?
No, that's perfect. That's right.
With a little marinara sauce right on the
and some cheese. Don't forget the cheese.
Cheese in his pocket.
God, and some bread.
Oh, God. All right. Go listen to her show online, WAAF.com, or if you're in the Boston area, WAAF and 10 to 3. You're the best. Love you. Okay, guys, that was Mistress Carey. How great is she? And there's a lot more we're going to talk about, because she told me about this doctor that does stuff with penises off the air that we got to talk about. But she's WAAF and just the best. And thank you for listening. And please keep telling your friends about the podcast. We want to keep building the numbers. And please leave comments and tell friends to leave comments. It would really, really be helpful. We'd really appreciate it if you just go to iTunes and leave a quick comment. And we'll see everybody next week. Thanks for listening, folks.
A Westwood One podcast production.